Thank you so much to everybody who showed up on Saturday. It was really nice to redo the Rage, Your Health, and Yourself workshop. I forgot to hit record the first time I did it, so I had to redo it, which meant more people were able to show up the second time around, and that was really cool. So thank you again, everyone. And if you watched the replay, or if I have emailed you the replay and you haven't watched it yet, this is your reminder to do that. I know it gets really easy to just, you know, forget about things that we've signed up for, especially when they're not live. So I'll be interested to see if you watch the replay and what you think about it. There's a link for a survey in the email that I sent you. And if you would like the replay, just send me an email and I'm happy to send you the info on that. The next workshop is going to be Saturday, April 6th at 10 a.m. Eastern, and it's all about maintaining friendships while living with a chronic illness. The overwhelming majority of us struggle with this, things like when to reach out, how to reach out, making plans because we might cancel or feeling like a burden, but also feeling resentful at the same time. It's tricky and it's complicated. So my hope is that you will gain a lot from this next workshop. Again, that's Saturday, April 6th at 10 a.m. And you can sign up at the link in the show notes. Additionally, if you are a resident of Georgia or Florida, then I have a therapy group that is starting on April 1st, 2024. The workshop that I just mentioned a moment ago, that's for anyone. It's not therapy. But this is a therapy group and is open to residents of the states that I'm licensed in. So this group will be 12 sessions long weekly. They're 90 minutes and they are virtual. They're via video. And I'll be every Tuesday from 3 to 4:30 p.m. starting April 1st. It comes with a digital workbook and the group format is a little bit of education where I'll be starting each session with an educational component around things like grief and identity work, working through anger, guilt and self-blame, fear of your body. That's a big one that we'll probably talk about a lot. And symptoms like brain fog, physical pain, chronic fatigue, dizziness, all of that. We'll be learning some pain management techniques and skills and practicing those in a way that is genuine and hopefully will stick. Because we can learn a lot of these things and then feel like we know it and then never do it or just feel like it doesn't work for us. And really, it might be that we didn't have that helping hand, that warmth throughout the learning process. I think that's what happens a lot of the time is we're trying to learn something in our brain. We don't have any support around it. And then we feel like we know it, but it didn't work for us because we didn't really have all of the follow through. And again, that follow through usually only happens when you have really warm, genuine support. So that's what I'm hoping to provide with this group. If you have out-of-network benefits with your insurance, then super bills will be provided. If not, then it's just a private paid group. And I want to offer a couple of bonuses as well. I'm calling them bonuses because if you live in Florida, this might not be feasible, but we're going to do an in-person meetup at the end of each month. And so that'll be 3 meetups in total, but that will be in Atlanta. If you're in Florida and you want to travel up this way, that would be amazing. But just to know that's not a requirement of the group and it's really just an extra thing that I want to do because I think virtual work is amazing. And sometimes that in-person aspect can really just tie everything together. That will be a bonus. And then another bonus session, and again, I'm calling this a bonus because it's not mandatory and it really depends on if you have someone you would want to bring with you or if they would even agree to attending. But at the end of the program, or maybe 2/3 of the way through, I haven't decided yet, there will be a session, a group session, where your family members can attend the group to learn about how they can better support you in your journey. So that's the group therapy program. And again, I will have a link in the description box below with more information for that. But if you're interested in either of those things, click those links or you can email me at destiny@destinywinters.com. Today's episode is with Dr. Jessica Rial. She's a pelvic floor physical therapist here in Georgia, and she has a deep passion for pelvic health rehab and loves supporting patients and clinicians alike as they journey in pelvic health. She's a board-certified specialist and the owner of Southern Pelvic Health, a multi-clinician specialized physical therapy practice with locations in Marietta, East Cobb, and Midtown Atlanta. Jessica's passion for the pelvic health rehabilitation field led to co-founding the annual Pelvicon, a conference for pelvic rehab by pelvic rehab PelvicCon brings over 600 professionals together each year for a weekend of learning and community. And as an educator, she's taught thousands of other pelvic rehabilitation providers and supported them in their professional journeys. Her deepest passion, however, is in helping her patients improve their pelvic health to get back to the lives that they love. The Chronic Illness Therapist podcast is meant to be a place where people with chronic illnesses can come to feel heard, seen, and safe while listening to mental health therapists and other medical professionals talk about the realities of treating difficult conditions. This might be a new concept for you, one in which you never have to worry about someone inferring that it's all in your head. We dive deep into the human side of treating complex medical conditions and help you find professionals that leave you feeling hopeful for the future. I hope you love what you learned here, and please consider leaving a review or sharing this podcast with someone you love. This podcast is meant for educational purposes only. For specific questions related to your unique circumstances, please contact a licensed medical professional in your state of residence. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited about being on your podcast. It's a really cool podcast that you're doing. It's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Why don't we start by you telling everyone where your practice is, what you do, and a little bit about what we're going to talk about today regarding men's pelvic health.
Yeah. So my name is Jessica Rial. I am a pelvic health physical therapist. Pelvic health is my passion. I have been working with this population since I was getting my doctorate. So it was like right around 2008, 2009 when I got started into pelvic health, and I just never looked back. I really fell in love with the population because the people that we work with, the diagnoses that we treat are often so life impacting to the individuals experiencing it. And they're often things that are just super private. And so, you know, we're working with people with bowel problems. I mean, and the reality is, like, if you can't poop, you're not telling all your friends, like, gosh, haven't pooped in 4 days. This is really uncomfortable. Most people don't talk about it. We're treating bladder leakage. We're treating, and other than some jokes on the, you know, at the trampoline parks with like the little group of moms, it's not like people are sitting there being like, hey, guess what? I just coughed and peed my pants. Like, you don't hear that. And we treat sexual dysfunction. We treat pelvic pain conditions. And so the very private nature of these conditions, honestly, it's what really drew me to the population and to realizing that we can make a big difference with these individuals, that and that it made such a big difference for their quality of life. And so that's kind of what got me there. I worked in outpatient settings for a while, and ultimately decided to open my own practice in 2019. My practice is Southern Pelvic Health. We started in 2019. It was just me renting a room out of a chiropractor's office, and we just grew from there. And so now we have a location in the Marietta, East Cobb area, north of Atlanta. And then we have a location in Midtown in Atlanta. And we have an awesome team of therapists. We're a completely pelvic health dedicated practice, which I deeply love. It was always a dream of mine to have a place where everyone loved the pelvis as much as I did. And that's what we have. So we completely study this population. We're like sharing treatment techniques in our spare time. Patients come in and they know that they're good company, that, hey, you know, this is not something where you're just being put in this back room at this big clinic and hoping no one knows why you're there. You're coming here and it's like everyone else here is here for the same stuff. And so that was my dream and my passion. And it's been really beautiful to see Southern Pelvic Health really embody that.
I love that so much. Yeah. You're all there for the same stuff, and there's no shame. And if there is, then you're witnessing other people and their shame. And that is healing. Like when we're both kind of experiencing that at the same time. Go ahead.
Oh, there's just so much value in realizing you're not alone.
Yeah.
And because so many people feel like they are. I mean, I remember when not now, because we are Southern Pelvic Health, and so people know, but when I worked at larger practices, there was always this assumption when patients would come in that they were the only patient with pelvic floor problems that I saw. Like they'd be like, oh, so you must treat like the whole gamut of pelvic health. You must do this. And I'm like, or the whole gamut of physical therapy. Like they're like, do you see back pain? Are you seeing like,
necks and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, this is what I do. It's all pelvic health. And they're surprised by that. And I think that really comes down to the misunderstandings that people have about the prevalence of these conditions. Because they're so private and people don't talk about it, we assume they're not happening, which is absolutely, completely false. And so, you know, when we look at these conditions, like bladder leakage, for example, well, research shows that somewhere around 1 in 2 to 3 women will experience bladder leakage. So it's like, hello, that is like somewhere around what, like everyone, you know, 50% of the population. Yeah. And, you know, constipation, it's the literal number one GI complaint in the country. Yeah, I mean, and I could just go on. And, you know, and I know you and I connected in talking about men's health. And that's it's interesting because in medicine, I would say pelvic health and male pelvic pain is actually one of the more underserved populations in pelvic health, which is funny because they tend to not be underserved in many other areas of medicine. But in pelvic health, they often are. And male pelvic pain is also very common. And, you know, and I would ask if you're listening to this, how often do you hear of men that you know who are dealing with pelvic pain? Probably not often, because most people don't want to tell their friends like, oh man, like really feel like there's a golf ball in my butt right now. Like that's not something people talk about. And the reality is that prevalence for men with pelvic pain approaches around 10%. And so that means if you are in a group of 20 men, it is likely that 2 of them deal with pelvic pain. And so that's the very interesting thing with these conditions is people just don't have any clue about how common they are. And honestly, it creates a huge barrier to treatment. Because if you don't think that the problem you have is common, it's hard for you to know where to seek help when it is hard.
And so much fear. I mean, that's what I work on a lot with all of my clients of all different types of pain syndromes and chronic illnesses is fear of your body. And if you don't even know, like,
100%,
that's a problem that other people experience and that we have treatments for because maybe your general practitioner doesn't know about it or. I know, like with my own OBs throughout pregnancy, I was like, you know, how do I prepare for a VBAC? For those who don't know, vaginal birth after cesarean. And you know, that used to be a big no-no. And they were just like, oh, like they literally said, and she was the kindest doctor. I really, really enjoyed the first doctor that I met. And she was just like, yeah, just like kind of, you know, just take care of yourself. Like, you know, just like she literally didn't have an answer. And she's like, you know, you just come in and you don't worry about a thing and we're going to take care of it. And then I had another one come in because you see different ones start your pregnancy. And like, she was just like, well, if a C-section happens, it happens. And I was like, of course, like I want my baby out and alive and well, of course I will take another C-section over a harmed baby.
Right.
But if they don't have to, and guess what? I had a successful VBAC 5 weeks ago. So, and they all thanks to my pelvic floor physical therapist. I mean, I couldn't have done it without her. So,
yeah. And you're right, like there's a lot, even when we go to birth, you know, that's not a population we've talked about yet, but that's a huge population for us. We work with people who are preparing for birth and helping them to connect with their pelvic floor and connect with their body to assist in the birth process and with rehab afterwards. And it's interesting because there actually is research on a lot of things people can do to be prepared and to have more success in their births. And but it just tends to be a gap in knowledge. It's and people are taking this into their own hands now. I think one of the beauties is that as, you know, we're the age of the internet, like where it's knowledge is at your fingertips. And I think that's been a really good thing because people are researching a lot more and they're, you know, taking their health into their own hands. But they shouldn't always have to, too. Like they should, you know, there should need to be more education for providers to be able to screen and be able to refer people when it's appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, definitely detoured a little bit into birth because that's fresh on my mind. But would love to kind of learn more about what it looks like when men come in, maybe even how you educate them. And if that's different than any other person who comes in or if it's kind of very much the same.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, it's different and the same because it's a lot of people are very surprised to learn that all people have pelvic floors. And so, you know, when people ask us as a pelvic health specialty practice, they're like, oh, you know, do you treat men? Do you treat trans people, do you treat, you know, all, and I'm like, well, do they have a pelvis? If they have a pelvis, yes, we will treat them because everyone has a pelvis and has a pelvic floor. And so all people can have dysfunction occurring around the pelvis. And so, you know, in talking about anatomical differences, the interesting thing is that the pelvic floor muscles themselves are actually extremely similar in all pelvises. There's just a little bit of differences based on someone's anatomy. And so, you know, when we think about the pelvic floor runs inside the pelvis like a bowl. It runs from the pubic bone in the front to the tailbone and wraps around the urethra. It wraps around the vagina, if you have one, and around the anus. And where those muscles sit, they do several very, very important jobs for the body. So one is that they are the deepest level of support for the organs in the pelvis. And so this, you know, in the case of, you know, a person with a vagina and a uterus, we are seeing these muscles sitting inside the pelvis and helping to provide support to the organs within the pelvis, working together with the fascia and the ligaments to help hold the organs in place. And we also see that these muscles provide some support around the prostate as well. These muscles are very involved in sphincteric control. I call it their popular function. So they contract to hold in urine. They relax to allow emptying. They do the same for the bowel. So contract to hold back, and they relax and lengthen to allow emptying. Then they provide a role for sexual function. And in many ways, this is similar, but a little bit different in individuals. And so we know that they will actually contract to pull blood into the pelvis. They can aid in erection. They also, because of their attachments around the clitoris, aid in clitoral arousal. They will rhythmically contract for orgasm and for ejaculation as well. So they contract and relax to allow for that. If a person is having insertion vaginally as part of sex for them, then they have to lengthen and open to allow for insertion as well. And then the muscles also are very involved in stability. So they play a role. They actually work together with your deep abdominal muscles, your breathing diaphragm, your low back muscles to stabilize the spine and the pelvis. There's been some interesting research looking at how these muscles relate to breathing. They're found to be really active with breathing. Dysfunction in these muscles has been found to be very common in people with low back pain. I believe it was approaching 90% of people with low back pain tend to have pelvic floor dysfunction. And they've been found to be involved even with like TMJ problems and neck problems and stuff too. So they're very important for stability in the body. Now, when we look at anatomy, I have a nice little model since we're targeting men's health and male pelvic health here. So just to point out this anatomy to you a little bit more. So you can kind of see here, we have a cross section of a pelvis. And so it's basically like we took someone and just kind of cut them in half here. So you can see right here, this is their spine coming up right here. We can see also, yeah, spine, sorry, right there. I see what they're doing. I'm sorry. I was like, this model is a little confusing. I think they're trying to show the spinal cord here as well. I was like, what is going on with this double spine situation? Okay. So then what you can actually see here, so we can see the penis right here, and there's the scrotum with the testicles here. So the pelvic floor muscles, you can actually appreciate them right here, looping this nice big loop of muscles around the rectum. So that's the rectum right here. And then you can see as I tilt this, here's the pelvic floor running right here. This muscle right here along the base, heading towards the base of the penis. We have this muscle also running here, also aiding these two muscles, aiding in erection and blood flow into the perineum. And then you can see if I remove this section here. So again, to orient you, we have the penis, we have where the testicles would be here, and there's the prostate right under the bladder. We can see the muscles sitting right under the prostate and how they're kind of circling around the urethra there as well. And so these muscles are really similar in all people. And so with that, they can fill a lot of the same functions. And so just like if we have, you know, someone postpartum who is having bladder leakage because of an injury they had during birth or as a result of their pregnancy, we can see another person who may have had a prostate removal surgery for prostate cancer, and they can have bladder leakage and And both people need retraining and treatment for their pelvic floor with slightly different thought processes and approaches based on why it's happening to begin with. Pelvic pain problems are really common in both in all populations as well. When we look at male pelvic pain, it's very interesting because it is often blamed on the prostate. And so a lot of times, if someone goes to see their urologist and they're having pain down in the perineum, somewhere in the pelvis, usually the first thing they will do is jump to the prostate being a problem. And it's interesting because the prevalence of male pelvic pain conditions, or they'll say chronic pelvic pain in men, chronic prostatitis is typically how it's termed, is around 10%. And 90 to 95% of those cases are not bacterial prostatitis, prostate-related problems. But they still tend to group them under this prostatitis category. So that creates a lot of issues. The issues we tend to see are that when these individuals get diagnosed, they're told it's a prostate problem and they're immediately put on antibiotics. So I've seen men who have been on like 4 to 6 rounds of antibiotics to treat this prostate infection that was never an infection to begin with. And part of that is because of where the muscles sit in the pelvis, the symptoms can mimic other symptoms. And so, you know, when the muscles, in the cases of pelvic pain like this, the muscles are often kind of tense and taut and irritated. And that can create symptoms of pain around the perineum. They can have rectal pain, or oftentimes we'll hear the sensation of something being in the rectum. So they'll say, it feels like there's something there. It feels like there's a golf ball in my rectum. Or when I sit, I feel like I'm sitting on a stick or something. And that's the muscles causing that. But the interesting thing is that sometimes a true infection of the prostate could cause some very similar symptoms. And so it becomes a little bit tricky, I think, from a diagnostic standpoint. And that's why I encourage, if you are going and seeing someone and they have said, I think it's prostatitis and I want to give you an antibiotic, ask them to culture for bacteria and make sure bacteria is present if they're going to treat based on a bacterial diagnosis. Because we know now in the literature that 90 to 95% of cases actually fall in this category that has been termed chronic prostatitis / chronic pelvic pain syndrome. And when they say chronic prostatitis, they clarify that it's non-bacterial, non-inflammatory, meaning like we're still going to call it prostatitis, but it actually is not something going on with the prostate at all. So most of the time in those cases, we know that there are really strong muscular components. We know that the nervous system can be really involved. And when I say the nervous system can be involved, I don't mean by any means that this is like in your head. What I mean is that when you've dealt with pain for a long time, the way your brain is protecting the body can lead to nerves around the pelvis becoming sensitized and increase their sensitivity. And so sometimes we'll see that we have this combination of overactive tense muscles and nerves that are very sensitive because your brain's wanting to protect you. And that's the much more common presentation that we tend to see for individuals dealing with pelvic pain.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Thanks for all of that education. I think it gives such a good picture and helps people grasp what's happening and be able to ask better questions, right? Mm-hmm. If you have that foundation of knowledge. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about treatment. You know, one thing that was coming up is, as you were talking about, it was like, okay, even with just erectile dysfunction, with so many different things that you mentioned, so many different roles that the pelvic floor plays, mm-hmm. the reason why someone might have erectile dysfunction could be one of 20 different reasons, it sounds like.
Correct.
And so you go to your doctor, they give you a prescription for Viagra and say, like, go have fun, right? Mm-hmm. What happens if you're taking Viagra, and like, what is the function of Viagra, and how is that also kind of similarly how you just said, you know, they might think it's a bacterial infection, but really like here's the other issue, and that's why the antibiotics don't really, they're not doing anything and maybe even doing harm. Same thing with Viagra. Can you kind of explain how that might play? Yeah.
Right. So Viagra is a medication that's going to assist in, you know, opening those blood vessels and shunting blood into the penis, right? And so it's It is definitely, I think, medication management for people who have erectile dysfunction can be huge. The reality is that with many of these conditions, especially as we look at sexual dysfunction, people often benefit from having a multidisciplinary team, because the reality is that there can be a lot of factors involved. And so when you take erectile dysfunction, it can be related to something with nerves happening in the pelvis. It can be related to them getting adequate blood flow into the pelvis. We know that there are big psychological components. And so many people benefit from working with counselors who have advanced training in sex therapy and helping people with those pieces. And then we know that the pelvic floor muscles can play a role as well. And so I think having this kind of team approach to helping people with these problems can be very, very useful. And that's what we aim to do, you know, with ED in particular, where I tell people, you know, our goal is to optimize your musculoskeletal and neuromuscular system to work in your favor. Now, with some problems like ED, I can't guarantee that helping their pelvic floor is going to be like the thing for them that helps it. But sometimes it makes a big difference. And so for us, at our options for treatment would be helping them to optimize their pelvic floor, which is making sure they have nice mobility in the muscles, that they know how to contract the muscles, relax the muscles, that they don't have areas of tension, restriction, overactivity in their muscles, addressing other pelvic problems as well. So if they have ED and pelvic pain, that's like a very different scenario for me than someone who just has plain AD and ED. So our goal is to try to address some of those other pieces as well and get them working in their favor. We also do shockwave therapy at my office, which has some good evidence for ED as well and improving blood flow into the penis. So
can you explain that? I've actually not heard of that.
Oh, yes. So shockwave therapy is kind of a new treatment, but basically it has acoustic energy that goes into the tissues, and it's been shown to lead to a migration of stem cells. It's been shown to lead to increased blood flow. And the evidence for erectile dysfunction and for helping with some musculoskeletal pain conditions is actually pretty encouraging. And so, and we've seen some nice results with it.
It makes me think that, you know, okay, so let's say it's not a musculoskeletal issue, right? Like erectile dysfunction. I would imagine if they're not breathing correctly, if they're doing this treatment that you're the shockwave treatment, and that psychologically makes them feel better, then their body relaxes more. And again, this goes like,
sure.
I always try to emphasize this on my podcast when we're starting to talk about psychosomatic and the nervous system. It doesn't mean it's all in your head, like you said earlier. It's just, if you feel better about a treatment you're receiving, or even the care you're receiving, your body physically relaxes, your muscles relax, all of that. You're building trust with your body, and that in and of itself can then alleviate the pain.
Totally. Yes. And I do think that that's a big piece of it, that, you know, connecting with the body and stuff. But I do think that, you know, in some cases, like with shockwave in particular, like it does, the research does show that it does tend to lead to better vascularization and can make a difference in terms of that piece too. But I do think it is this multifactorial piece most of the time for many individuals. And I think that as we look at people with pelvic pain, that is 100% true as well. And so, you know, with you'd mentioned about like treatment and like, what does that kind of look like? And so, you know, for us, when we evaluate someone, so they come into the clinic, we like to start by sitting down with them and we get a super comprehensive history. And so exploring all of the things that they have been, that their journey, what their journey has looked like to this point, so that we can understand how, from a musculoskeletal perspective and a behavioral perspective, what are the factors going on that might be involved in their pain. We explore everything from their bowel history, their bladder history, surgical stuff, other medical comorbidities. We explore treatments, what their journey's been with this diagnosis, where they've been and what treatment they've had so far. And it gives us this nice picture that helps us kind of put together. I tell, when I mentor other clinicians, I'll talk about, you know, we're creating the story. And so we need to kind of create this story as to what has the journey been that's led us to the state that the patient is dealing with right now. because, and that's super important, especially as we think about the pelvic floor, because the other interesting function of the pelvic floor that I didn't mention is this threat response. And so this is very fascinating to me. So the pelvic floor has actually been studied as people are that basically when people experience threat or perceived threat, the pelvic floor actually goes into tension. And so in this study, it's interesting, they were comparing individuals with painful sex versus individuals who did not have painful sex. And their theory was that people with painful sex would have more of a protective response of their pelvic floor. But that's actually not what they found. They found that all people, when there was a threat or a perceived threat, went into contraction of their pelvic floor. And this is interesting because when we work with people with pelvic pain, well, what I find is that sometimes just the journey to get diagnosed is a threat to the system. That when you have seen 5 different doctors and no one has helped you with your symptoms, it's really hard to not worry that something is really bad going on and you have this huge threat to the person happening, which then leads to more and more tension. And so sometimes just removing the threat and naming things and saying, hey, we actually do know what's going on. We actually know a lot about this condition and we have a plan for what we can do to address this. That takes that threat away and then can allow things to start to relax. But what we do is, you know, once we evaluate patients, and get their story, we'll take them through a movement screen. And our screen lets us just see what's happening head to toe. It lets us explore, you know, if someone has this old neck injury, what's happening there, what's happening with their spine and their hips. And then we more specifically will examine the structures around the pelvis. So like the abdominal wall, the hips, and the pelvic floor. Now the pelvic floor, because of where it sits inside the pelvis, it can be examined a couple different ways. One of the more optimal ways to examine the pelvic floor is by doing an internal examination. And this can be done either vaginally or rectally. Therapists like myself who really specialize in this often have had extensive training in doing this and evaluating people and treating the muscles that are inside the pelvis. And so it's important if you're going to see someone to make sure you see someone who has had advanced training in this and really is knowledgeable about working with these conditions. So we examine differently than medical offices do. We use one finger that can be inserted vaginally or rectally and can feel the muscles. And what we look for is, are the muscles tender and sensitive? How well do they contract? How well do they relax? And what's their coordination? And then that gives us this full picture and lets us really start patients on comprehensive programs to address what we noted during the exam. And so, you know, when it comes to tension, a lot of people assume that having an exam should be uncomfortable. And so people will assume like, oh, a rectal exam, yeah, it should hurt a little bit. That's actually not true. And same with a vaginal exam, is that healthy muscles don't hurt. And so you might feel pressure with a rectal exam. It might feel like you need to have a bowel movement or something like that, but it actually shouldn't be painful at all. And if it is, it's a sign of dysfunction happening somewhere in the tissues. So that's kind of where we go exam-wise. And then from a treatment standpoint,
I'm curious how, you know, my brain is going to the psychological component. So when you have a patient come in who is very, very scared, what does that process look like before you even get to undressing?
Totally. And so, you know, we are very, at my practice, we're very patient-centered and trauma-informed in how we treat. And so what does that mean? It basically means that we view the therapeutic relationship as a partnership between us and the patient, where we have this knowledge of physical therapy and about the body, and they have this knowledge of them. And we're going to come together to determine what the best examination and treatment approach for them is. And so what that could mean is that if a person is coming and they come in and they're like, an internal exam freaks me out, I'm nervous about that, then we talk about it. And oftentimes we'll say, you know what, let's put that on the back burner. Let's not do that right away. We have other ways to examine. And so we might examine more externally for them. For some patients, they're okay with maybe undressing and having an external exam where we can see how the muscles are moving externally, maybe push on the muscles externally. Through their skin, but not actually enter and not do an internal exam. Other patients don't want to address at all. And they feel like they're nervous about that. And so what I would say is, if that feels like you, if you're hearing this and you're like, I do not want to undress, know that you can see practices like mine where you would never be pressured to do that. The way we look at it is, we're going to have this partnership together and determine the best plan for you. And that might look, and I'll say on that note, I have patients who come in and they're like, oh my gosh, like, do you want me to just take off my clothes right now? Like, they're like, do whatever. And then I have patients who, you know, because of for any reason, you know, individuals who've had traumatic experiences in the past, individuals who just are nervous about that and don't want to do that, it may feel more cautious. And for some of them, once they get to know us, they're like, you know, let's go ahead and do that internal exam. And then others may decide they never want to have an internal exam. But a good therapeutic relationship would be one where there's never any pressure to do something that you don't want to do, and to where we are going to tailor the exam and the treatment to you based on your knowledge of you. And that I think creates this beautiful therapeutic partnership.
Yeah, I think if you have someone who's pressuring you, my brain immediately says they don't have enough tools in their toolbox, right? They're pressuring you because it's the only tool they have or they know. And therefore, that might even just be a sign that they're not even the right practitioner for
you. Not the right fit for you. Yeah. And I would encourage you to be honest with your clinicians. And I know it can be challenging when you see someone and, you know, they're in this position of authority speaking on the pelvis and stuff too. And they say, I think we should do this exam. It can be hard to say, I don't want to do that. And so I would encourage you to speak up. You know, the hope would be you'd be seeing an informed provider who would be offering you options for exam, and you can pick what resonates with you in a way that doesn't feel negative. But if you do leave an appointment feeling negative, I would just encourage you to recognize that there are a lot of providers who do this, and finding a provider who might be a little more specialized, who might have a little more training, a little more experience, might lead you down the road of finding someone who might be a better fit in your journey.
Totally. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I had another question around muscle pain versus nerve pain. And, you know, because, and maybe we didn't even go in, like, so when we're talking about the pelvic floor, right, that's all muscle, which you explained at the beginning. And so we are really talking about musculoskeletal pain. Where does nerve pain come in with your specialty, and how do you approach that? And what does that look like for a patient?
Sure. So nerves are very involved. And so we always say we treat the musculoskeletal and the neuromuscular components. And so we care deeply about what's happening with nerves, because the reality is that, you know, you have these nerves that are running from your spine out to these areas. And sometimes it can be very tricky in the case of a person having pain to know what the pain is coming from. And the interesting thing is that muscles can irritate nerves and nerves can irritate muscles. And so we have to explore that. And so how do we explore that? So what we do from an exam standpoint is we want to see what's happening with the muscles, but we also want to assess what's happening with the nerves. And we do that by assessing the spine and looking at, you know, there are nerves that come out of the low back that actually can go through the abdominal wall and go down to this area of the pelvis. And so we assess what's happening with the low back. We look at certain symptom patterns that make us start thinking, okay, this is nerve. Nerve stuff is very common in cases of like testicular pain, penile pain. It's really common for nerves to be involved. So we're going to assess basically, does the movement pattern of the patient and their symptom presentation make me start to suspect nerves? And if so, I'm going to examine what's happening along the course of where that nerve is to see if that is leading to reproduction of their symptoms, or if there's dysfunction there that might indicate to me that there's something happening with the nerves in that area. We also care about the nerves coming out of the sacrum. There's a specific nerve called the pudendal nerve that comes out of the sacrum levels 2 through 4 and does provide innervation into the pelvic floor and around the perineum area. So those of us who specialize in this know that there are specific areas where we can examine and assess that nerve and see if that nerve is contributing to the pain the patient is experiencing. We also know that nerves tend to cause slightly different symptoms than muscles do, although sometimes they're kind of intertwined. It's like that Venn diagram where there's like these overlapping things. So pain can be muscles or nerves. We know that burning type symptoms often have big neural components, often, not always, but burning symptoms, any electrical type feelings can be nervy. Of course, if they have tingling or anything like that, that's a nerve type symptom. Whereas if I have a patient complaining of more of like a deep ache internally, that often makes me think a little more muscle. So it's kind of a combo of what's happening with their symptoms and what story does that tell me? And then I want to make sure that I'm seeing for them with evaluation that anatomically what we're seeing matches what I'm noting from a symptom standpoint. But most of the time, I'll tell you, for those of us who've been doing this for a while, I actually like play a little game with myself. When I hear a patient's story, I can almost always guess what I'm going to find on exam because we just, you know, you just recognize these patterns. Now, I allow myself to be surprised. So I still examine very specifically. And there's occasional times where I'm like, okay, interesting. I did not think we were going to find this. And we did. But there's a lot of times where I'm like, and exactly as I suspected, this is exactly what we found. So,
yeah, I love that because it's the intuition that you build over, you know, a decade.
Oh, 100%.
Of, plus of
work. All the reps.
And I love the, when you do find these patterns between patients, because again, so many people feel so alone or they feel like their pain is no one else understands their pain. And the reason for that can be multifaceted, you know, whether it's just doctors who didn't understand and therefore now they have this ingrained belief of like, well, then no one knows.
Yeah.
There's so many psychological components that go along with pain that, again, doesn't mean at all. That's not at all that your pain is caused by these psychological factors, but these psychological factors do contribute to worsening pain. And when you do get to fix the problem, like when we were talking about shockwave therapy, you said, you know, the research shows like it works regardless of any kind of psychosomatic component. Yes. And when it starts to work, then it reduces your fear. And then as your fear reduces, other treatments can work better. And so it's just so bidirectional, kind of like how you were just talking about with the muscles and the nerve. It's all so bidirectional. And we just don't talk like that in our society. I think that's why people get so confused about, well, I tried this treatment, it didn't work. It literally could work 5 years later because you've done all these other things that have like made room for that to now work. That was my experience anyway.
100%. And, you know, and I do think that the psychological piece is so incredibly important. I mean, and having trust in your providers. And that's why I encourage people, you know, you want to make sure you are a good fit with your provider. If you do not feel trust with them and you're not sure, honestly, you're less likely to get better. There's research that shows that, you know, liking your provider actually is predictive of your success in treatment, which I know can sound a little bit like wooey to say, but the reality is that as you consider the consequences of liking your provider, okay, liking my provider means I'm more likely to go to my follow-up visits because I like being with them. It means I'm more likely to follow through with what they tell me to do because I trust them and I have that there. It means that from a safety standpoint, for my nervous system, I'm going to feel more safe in the plan that we're doing because I like them and I believe that they have my best interests at heart. So I think it goes much deeper than just the, do you like your provider, to how that actually impacts your nervous system in what you're doing with treatment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, your nerves, like I mentioned earlier, your muscles can just relax, or even your heart rate variability. We know that being in a trustworthy environment is something that evens out your heart rate variability, which for those who don't know, it's just another kind of factor we look at sometimes when it comes to longevity and overall health. Mm-hmm. So, it was interesting. It's interesting because I worked with a chiropractor once who did like a heart rate variability test, kind of like pre and post treatment. Uh-huh. And through that process and kind of that was where I first learned about heart rate variability. And I was researching it, looking, and I learned about this trust factor. And it's almost like, okay, well, your heart rate variability can improve by the end of a treatment, maybe even sometimes, not because the treatment actually worked, but because you had so many interactions with someone you trusted. You like being in that office now, like your body is just at a state of, so it's not to like dismiss the work that was done there, but also, and also just to say like that trust, just because your heart rate variability evens out from being in a trusting environment doesn't mean that it's now, we're now dismissing that. It's like, no, that just means you need to be around more people. that you trust. And so we kind of start to go down that path of how do we build you community and all of that.
I 100% agree. And I think, you know, in my mind, our goal is to get everything working in the patient's favor as much as possible. And honestly, like everything you just said, that was a big piece of what I wanted when we opened Southern Pelvic Health. You know, I run Southern Pelvic Health with my husband. And as we talked about, like, what is Southern Pelvic Health going to be? I wanted it to be a place of healing that, you know, it kind of this both and situation of, you know, I hate, one of my big pet peeves is when people will say something like, oh, you know, he's a really great doctor, but he has terrible bedside manner. And I'm like, well, then he's not a great doctor. Because just because you have the technical knowledge that's not the only thing that matters in care. And so, you know, for me, I wanted to have a place where we had excellent technical knowledge to help patients with their rehab. And we aim to create an environment that was conducive to healing. And we really strive to do that. I mean, from the people we hire to be at the front desk, so that when patients come in, we want their first interaction to be kind. We want them to feel like, wow, okay, I'm in a place where people genuinely care about my health and my journey and me as a person. And we aim to literally from everything we did, like from the paint colors we chose to the art we put on the walls, to the snacks we have in the waiting room, to all of that. The hope is that everything leads to this nice space where a patient can feel like they're in a place that can facilitate healing. And again, like you said, that can't be a sole thing. Like if we did that and then we had terrible clinicians who provided really bad care, no one's going to get better. But in my mind, I feel like
both are important.
Both can be important. And let's facilitate healing as much as we can on all angles for the patient.
Yes. Yeah. There's a Facebook group here in Georgia for people giving birth. And a lot of people talk about this one doctor at this one place where they're like, oh, he has terrible bedside manner. Or like they'll say, like, if you resonate with him, you know, then he's great. But like he's very, you know, kind of like blunt and direct. But So there's a lot of like positive feedback about him. And what it made me think about a lot, because I'm with you on this, like, I like things to feel homey and I want things to feel compassionate and I want to be validated. But if you are actually like more of that kind of like person who that you actually don't want that, you like just give me the straight facts, like, and you want somebody who can just be very clinical with you, then that's actually what's going to build trust for you with your provider or more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just.
Yes. Although I would say you can have both true. So like, I think that
totally
it's like the skill of the clinician is meeting patients where they are too. And like, I think that, you know, most people who like a pure, like, I just need to know that the person I'm seeing is super knowledgeable and like, I don't care about this stuff. It's not like they're going to be bothered being in my nice clinic, like their tea and stuff. Like they're not going to be bugged by that. But as a clinician, I need to recognize that this is the person who might want me to actually print off the anatomy thing. And they're like, which muscle was that? Can you spell obturator internus? Like those are they want to know the specifics. And so I think if we can meet people with where they are without sacrificing those other things too.
100%. Yeah. I think that's where, you know, intuition just comes from. And
totally.
If you don't have, so yeah, you're able to kind of cater to all of that. Whereas if you don't have that compassionate muscle, then you can't cater to the ones who need that. And that's, you know, I think that's the, when you experience that over and over again as a patient, it leads to what you said earlier, where it's like this negative experience after negative experience after negative experience. And now you just think you're broken when really you just probably needed some breath work. It's like some pelvic floor kind of related. And I am not saying that we could get down another track of like breath work and how it's touted as a cure, but for everything these days, it's not that. It's just that we do have to be super aware of our breath.
And I feel like, okay, yes, is breath work touted as more than maybe sometimes it does? Sure. Is it super, super valuable? Yes. And is there power to a person actually learning to breathe and let go? 100%. Does the diaphragm affect the nervous system deeply? Yes. So I think I agree with you. I think that it's yes. I mean, people, the amount of medical trauma that many people face in getting help is substantial. And it is, you know, and I think providers can either be part of a healing journey for someone, or they could really amplify the negativity that they've experienced. I mean, I have patients that are very nervous now seeing any medical provider because they've had such horrible experiences that it's like a risk. They're like, every person they see, they're like, is this going to be a positive for my journey? Or am I going to leave this feeling more broken and more dysfunctional and bad, you know?
Yeah, there's a workbook that I give in my monthly workshops, and one of the worksheets in there is all about like getting to know your medical team, but understanding them from a place of like, what do they provide to me? What do I like about them? What do I not like about them? Kind of like knowing the enemy is better than, mm-hmm. than not, because you know what to expect. And so maybe you really do trust the knowledge of your doctor. Maybe they are kind of an asshole. And so you have to recognize, like, if you're not willing to switch or you can't because you don't have mm-hmm. access to anyone else.
Yep.
At least let's just recognize that. Okay, he's an asshole. And like, but I really do trust him to do this surgery or this procedure on me. And so that can give you a sense of safety even when the rest isn't there. Ideally, you would have someone who can give you all of the above. But totally. Yeah.
But you're right. Sometimes that's not an option. And, you know, one of the things I actually will prep my patients a lot of times, if they are going to see someone and they've had a bad experience or anything, they almost have to put up some shields to go in and say, okay, what are we wanting out of this provider? And okay, I trust them for doing X procedure and I want to have that procedure. Okay. Is there a chance they're going to say something very unhelpful? Sure. Do they think that this treatment that I really like is like kind of junk? Maybe. So I'm going to shield up against any comments they make about that and allow them to do what I want them to do in this relationship. And I think there's a lot of help, like you said, in even just like that naming and being like, yes, this provider is an asshole. And I'm going to go there and I'm going to be ready for that. And because then it's not shocking when they are, because they're just being who you expected them to be, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Hopefully this is not many providers. I think, and I will say clarification, there's so many wonderful providers who care deeply about their patients and are providing amazing care in pelvic health and in all diagnoses. And there's some really bad ones, you know,
and
also therapists, right? Like there's like great ones. And then there's people where I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that they just did that treatment with that patient. Like, ugh.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, for sure. And also, I think it's so important for people to really understand the different personalities. And like, you might think someone was terrible because your personalities were so not a match.
Yeah.
And they might actually be a fantastic clinician and like, they're highly loved. I mean, think about your professors in grad school. Like,
totally.
You know, same thing. Like, people would love them. And then you'd go in and be like, I hate this guy. Like, what is wrong with him? Like, it's just a clash. Or the opposite. Everyone hated them and now you love them.
Yes.
So that's the work from the mental health therapy side is like,
yes,
we need to figure out like some of those things, because if it is just a personality clash, now you don't have to take it personally. You can make a decision of like, again, do I stick with this person and I just know what to expect? Or do I really say like, no, my nervous system can't tolerate that, even though I know it and I understand it's just a personality clash. It's not personal. But I cannot tolerate that level of like lack of compassion. I need that. Then we have to figure out how to find you a new provider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. I think that's great. I mean, I think it is. Yes, I think everything you said is awesome. And I think preparing patients in that way is so important for them to actually build their medical team that's going to be the best fit for them.
Yeah. Awesome. Is there anything else you want to tell us about like your clinic or, you know, what you kind of offer virtual versus in-person, and if there's anything else that we haven't talked about?
Sure. Yeah. So we do offer both virtual and in-person care. For people who live in Georgia, we are able to offer virtual physical therapy. If people live outside of Georgia, we're not able to offer that. We do offer coaching for them, which for some people is really helpful just in terms of navigating their condition. But we see patients at our East Cobb Marietta office and at our Midtown office. I think one thing I would just say is if you are listening to this and it's kind of resonating with you that you've dealt with these things and you have felt stuck, just know that there's help available. Know that while problems can be common, it doesn't mean they're inevitable and it doesn't mean there's nothing you can do to do about it. And so if you're dealing with pelvic pain, if you are dealing with bladder leakage or constipation or, you know, any of those things, just know that there are options. And also, I would say, know that physical therapists, just like other professionals, are all different. And so, you know, if you saw a physical therapist in the past and it wasn't helpful, that doesn't mean that physical therapy isn't helpful for you. It means that the physical therapist you saw used an approach that wasn't optimal for you. But it might mean that a different physical therapist would have a completely different approach that would be really good for you. So I would just encourage you to seek second opinions, advocate for yourself, do research so that you can really find the care that ultimately is helpful for you in your healing journey.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that's all very, very important to constantly be remembering, because it can be such a daunting journey trying to find providers. And but yeah, there's help out there.
Yes. And feel free to connect with me. You know, I'm on Instagram at Southern Pelvic Health. My clinic is at southernpelvichealth.com. So you can message me through that. We offer free 15-minute consultations. And so if you're kind of unsure about this stuff or you have some questions, just feel free to connect with me that way. We're very happy to support you in your journey.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you learned something new today, consider writing it down in your phone notes or journal and make that new neural pathway light up. Better yet, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a DM on Instagram, email me, or leave a voice memo for us to play on the next show. The way you summarize your takeaways can be the perfect little soundbite that someone else might need. And lastly, leaving a review really helps others find this podcast, so please do if you found this episode helpful. And P.S., clicking subscribe ensures you'll be here for the next episode. See you then.